The BMJ has just published two studies and an editorial that call into serious doubt the widespread practice of prescribing added calcium in food or pill form to people over age 50. Our guest this week, Dr. Mark Boland, is an author on both studies. He holds an appointment as an associate professor of medicine at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. Welcome, Dr. Boland. And I'd like to congratulate you and your co-authors for what seems an exhaustive analysis of the available evidence on calcium. It could not have been easy.
No, it took us a couple of years to go from start to finish.
Taking the two studies together, can you describe briefly what your main findings were? Sort of an elevator summary of your findings.
Okay, so we did two systematic reviews trying to gather together all the evidence of for increasing calcium intake, either by the diet or from taking supplements, on bone density and fracture. So looking first at bone density, there are quite a lot of RCTs that have been done. There's about nearly 60, and they show fairly consistent results that increasing calcium intake, either from diet, say by taking milk, or by taking supplements, has fairly similar effects. So at about 1 year, there's a 1-2% increase in bone density, and that doesn't change subsequently, so there's no further increases.
Even if you, I'm sorry to interrupt, but even if you continue, even after looking for 2 years and the patients are still on these supplements or added dietary sources, there's still no added change beyond the 1-2%.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, exactly. So the changes we saw at 1 year were almost identical to the changes we saw at 2 years. Mm-hmm. And there were a small number of studies that went beyond that. They were only for calcium supplements. But again, there was no difference between the results and later studies compared to the 1 year results.
Pardon me again for interrupting. There was no difference even when that calcium was given with vitamin D.
Yeah, so we did a number of subgroup analyses. So there was no difference of calcium as monotherapy or calcium with vitamin D.
Okay.
There was also no difference in studies where the baseline calcium intake was high, so say over 800 milligrams a day, compared to where it was lower.
And so that was the bone mineral density paper. Now, you did another paper investigating the effect of these supplements on fracture risk.
Yeah. So we were mainly interested in the dietary relationship between dietary calcium intake and fracture, because that hadn't been reported before, whereas there had been systematic reviews of calcium supplements and fracture outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at dietary calcium intake first. There were only two RCTs of increasing calcium intake that had reported fracture outcomes, and both of them were small, and the fracture outcomes were secondary endpoints. So there are only 260 people in those trials, so we couldn't draw any conclusions from that.
So there were only two, you said CTs, you mean clinical trials?
RCTs.
So randomized clinical trials. Okay.
Randomized, yeah.
I just wanted to be clear.
Yes, I said RCTs, I think, earlier on.
No, that's quite all right.
That's what I mean. Yeah, so there were only two small RCTs, so we couldn't draw any conclusions from that. So then we went to the next level of evidence down, so cohort studies. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of cohort studies that report the relationship between the baseline calcium intake and your subsequent risk of fracture. So we found 44 cohort studies overall. And in those studies, almost all of them reported no relationship between your baseline calcium intake and your subsequent risk of fracture. And that was consistent for total fracture, hip fracture, vertebral fracture, and forearm fracture.
Mm-hmm.
And we also looked at the relationship between milk intake and dairy intake and fracture risk, and again found much the same thing again. So most of the studies reported no association between baseline intake of milk or dairy products and subsequent risk of fracture. A small number of studies did report relationships between calcium intake and risk of fracture, but generally the risk was quite small. So the odds ratio or relative risk of having increased fracture risk associated with a low calcium intake was always less than 2. So overall, we concluded from that there was no good evidence for a relationship between baseline calcium intake and your subsequent risk of fracture. Finally, we looked at studies of calcium supplements, and there were 26 randomized controlled trials of calcium supplements that had reported fracture outcomes. And overall, when you pulled all the results, there was a small reduction in risk of total fracture and vertebral fracture with calcium supplements in those trials. So the risk estimate for total fracture was an 11% reduction, and for vertebral fracture was a 14% reduction.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no effect on hip fracture or forearm fracture in the study. But one interesting thing was that the risk reduction appeared to be related to the quality of the study. So in the 4 trials that were at lowest risk of bias, so these were large, double-blind, randomized placebo-controlled trials with fracture as the primary endpoint. In those 4 trials, there was no reduction in risk of fracture at any site.
And you excluded some studies from the fracture analysis, as you said, because of their increased risk for bias. Can you walk me through how you determined that bias risk? What are the markers of increased bias in a study like this?
Well, we tried to follow the Cochrane guidelines for that. So we started off, the approach that we used is we started off assigning every study as low risk of bias, and when there was something that would increase the risk of bias, we moved it up a scale from low to moderate and eventually to high. So the things that we considered as most important were blinding of participants.
Okay.
So if you had an open label study, we considered that to be at higher risk, whereas a double-blind placebo-controlled trial was the lowest, we considered the lowest risk of bias.
Okay.
Then we also considered the size of the study as an important factor as to whether the study was primarily looking at risk of fracture or it was a small study looking at bone density or some other endpoint, and fractures were just reported as a secondary endpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And in many of those studies, that fractures hadn't been rigorously evaluated, so they were just self-reported by participants.
Whereas
in the lowest risk of studies, the fractures were all independently verified.
Okay.
Those were the main things that we used.
So to summarize, although adding calcium increases bone density, it does so only modestly, and the effect doesn't increase with prolonged therapy, correct?
Yeah, you could even go a little bit further and say that rather than modestly, you could say to a very small extent.
Mm-hmm.
The average bone loss in a postmenopausal woman is about 1% per year. So taking calcium supplements or increasing calcium from your diet is equivalent to about preventing about 1 year of loss.
I see.
Of normal postmenopausal bone loss.
So it's like forestalling that 1 year of loss for 1 year.
For 1 year, which I think is pretty small.
You're right. So why then, I mean, you know, given this evidence, why do you, in your experience, why are so many people, especially women, on these supplements?
I think that's a a really, really good question and difficult one to answer. I think the results from our study won't come as a surprise to many of the researchers who are actively involved in the field, because these studies have been published in the last 15 years, and lots of them have been published, and they've generally been negative studies. So I think that it's widely recognised amongst researchers anyway that calcium only had small effects. But on the other hand, patients and clinicians have been getting very strong messages from osteoporosis advocacy groups and groups that write guidelines about the importance of calcium. So I think almost all guideline groups say that you need to take at least 1,000 milligrams a day of calcium if you're an older person to maintain bone health. And those guidelines haven't really changed in the last 15 to 20 years, despite all the accumulating evidence over that time that calcium supplements and, more recently, increasing dietary calcium intake has only very small effects on bone health.
What may be new is that there's evidence now that the oversupplementation of calcium can lead to complications, and I guess the most worrisome are cardiovascular problems have been suspected of being caused by calcium. Is that right?
That came from our research group. We did a clinical trial of about nearly 1,500 women trying to see whether calcium supplements could prevent fractures, and we found that they didn't prevent fractures, but to our surprise, there was a small increase in the risk of heart attack with calcium supplements in that study. We had actually pre-specified cardiovascular events as a secondary endpoint in the study, thinking that calcium supplements might actually be beneficial because they seem to improve your lipid profile a little bit and they lower your blood pressure a little bit for a short period of time. So we thought, well, maybe those positive effects might translate into a reduction in cardiovascular events. But actually, to our surprise, the effect went the other way. So what we did next was we gathered up all the data from all the trials that had been published on calcium supplements to that point, and looked at the effect of calcium supplements on cardiovascular events in that study. So we did an individual patient data meta-analysis as well as a trial level analysis, and that suggested that there's about a 30% increase in the risk of heart attack and possibly a 20% increase in the risk of stroke with taking calcium supplements. And then we've gone on to do other analyses as well, suggesting that that risk is increased regardless of whether you take calcium by itself or you take calcium with vitamin D supplements. The other risk that has emerged in the last 10 years from calcium supplements came from the Women's Health Initiative study, where there was an increased risk of kidney stones in that study in women taking calcium and vitamin D supplements. And the interesting thing about the risk-benefit profile with calcium supplements is that if you just count up the number of people who had fractures prevented in each of the big clinical trials, so for example the Women's Health Initiative, in the Women's Health Initiative, if you take the extra number of kidney stones in the calcium and vitamin D group compared to the placebo group, you find that that number is greater than the fractures that were prevented in the calcium and vitamin D group compared to the placebo group. And it was the same in our study of calcium supplements. There were more heart attacks and strokes caused than fractures prevented. And one other study showed that there were more women admitted to hospital with acute gastrointestinal symptoms than there were fractures prevented. So in each of these individual studies, the risk-benefit profile for calcium supplements was unfavorable.
you talk about that in the discussion of your paper, those that the risk benefit profiles, and it was very interesting that women given these supplements had more bad side effects than the had more, as you said, kidney stones than fracture preventions, and I guess one of the number needed to treat to prevent a fracture was something on the order of...
Now, I've got the numbers in front of me. To prevent one vertebral fracture, it was 489 people treated for 6.2 years.
Okay.
And to prevent one fracture at any site, it was 77 for 5.5 years.
Okay. All right. Now, for the clinician who's... it's not researchers who are prescribing calcium, but it's the clinicians who are fielding the questions from patients. So for a clinician, what's the central message? What should they do differently this week, having read your paper, than they did last week?
Well, I think in medicine we never like to jump into things, because I think we're inherently conservative.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is time for them to review whether they should be prescribing their patients calcium supplements for vitamin D. In New Zealand, we have largely stopped prescribing calcium supplements for fracture prevention over the past 5 years. And so there's been about an 80% reduction in prescriptions for calcium supplements since we first published our research about an increased risk of cardiovascular events. So I think it's time for clinicians elsewhere to probably do the same, to stop prescribing calcium supplements for the prevention of fractures. And I think they can tell their patients who are worried about calcium intake that there's very little evidence that different levels of calcium intake is associated with risk of fracture, so they don't have to be greatly concerned about the amount of calcium that they're taking in their diet.
So the Western diet, so-called, is usually rich enough in calcium so that people who don't have other problems that could contribute to calcium loss are perfectly fine going on eating a normal diet without supplementation.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable thing to say.
Okay.
There will be some people who, for medical reasons, may continue to need calcium supplements. But I think, as you say, for the average person who has an average diet and tries to eat in a healthy manner, I don't think they need to be particularly concerned about the amount of calcium that they're taking.
Okay, well, I want to thank you, Dr. Boland, for rearranging your schedule to spend some time with us today.
No problem. Thanks very much.
That was the 186th Clinical Conversation. All its predecessors are available and searchable at this address, podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from the NEJM Group, and Kristen Kelly is my executive producer. Thank you so much for listening.